And welcome on into Studio 2, Thursday, May 23rd. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarant.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Can't believe this is the final Thursday before Memorial Day, which is the unofficial start of summer. Yay!
Time has a way of really catching you by surprise. I've noticed that's a theme. You're always surprised by how deep we are into the year.
I'm like, it's flown by. It's flown by. And so to prepare you all for the unofficial start of summer, we're going to be talking about the Jersey Shore.
What else would we talk about?
And full disclosure,
okay,
I am not like a Jersey Shore person. Like, I've been living in Philly well over a decade. Mm-hmm. I've only been to the shore like 3 times. But we have a Jersey Shore person coming in to talk about it.
Peter, but that's good, though. You're objective.
I'm objective. Yeah. And this person is a shore aficionado.
Okay.
Peter Genovese.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Author of The Ultimate Guide to the Jersey Shore. Loves all things Jersey Shore. Is going to sell it. Is going to convince us.
Is going to sell you.
I think I'll be sold at the end. I'm going to put that out there. So, because I've been reading some of his work and he loves it. So we're going to talk about that. We'll also have Henry Savage from the Philadelphia Inquirer, who's going to talk with us later this segment and give us all the updates on the rules, all the things that have changed as far as regulations.
A lot of rules.
The Jersey Shore. Yeah, curfews, backpack bans.
No cabanas. Well, we're giving away the whole segment by listing them, but we will talk to Henry later in this segment. And we would love to hear from you about your favorite shore spots, your shore thoughts, maybe your shore tricks. I really feel like this would be a good audience participation show because we have a lot of folks out there that, like Peter, are shore, what'd you say, aficionados.
Yeah, okay, share your memories. Yeah,
okay,
we hear
aficionados, email us, studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499. Again, that's studio2@whyy.org. And then the final segment today is a story I'm very excited to bring you, in part because it's a story from a Studio 2 listener and a longtime WHYY listener. It's his personal story. He bought it to me first, actually, I believe, at a WHYY open house that we had with members, and he was telling me about this story. It's linked to Memorial Day, the actual holiday, not the beach weekend aspect of it. And so very excited to bring that to you in the final segment today.
I'm looking forward to that. It's, you know, when you produce something, I'm like, yay, we get to do that only so often. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Don't set the bar too high. We don't want to disappoint people.
And now we got to do some news.
We never disappoint people with the news chat. And let's start on I-95.
Yeah.
Northeast Philadelphia. Of course, you know, a little less than a year ago, it was all shut down because of that major overpass collapse, truck fire, the miraculous reopening of some lanes less than 2 weeks later. We remember that story. Perhaps we forgot that it actually has not been fully reopened until now. Southbound side of the highway fully reopened today, all 4 lanes. Northbound will reopen tomorrow, also all 4 lanes. So we have 8 lanes of fury all running by tomorrow, sort of the coda of this long saga that began with the tragedy last summer. Here is Shailen Batt. He is the Federal Highway Administrator who was on site today to talk about the completion of the project.
As the Federal Highway Administrator, I've seen bridge incidents in California, Connecticut, obviously Baltimore, and the terrible tragedy there. But I will tell you that every time I'm dealing with one of these now, people are using the efforts of Pennsylvania around the I-95 bridge as a benchmark. I cannot tell you the number of times I've heard, whatever you all did in Pennsylvania, that's what we want to see here.
We're the benchmark for a good thing.
That's pretty cool.
All right.
And if
I'll take that.
And if people don't remember, because I watched the live stream when it originally happened.
Sure.
It was up. It took them only 12 days to get that temporary road set up so we could reopen I-95. You know, kudos to the folks. I don't know what the timeline or how long it should have taken to get this permanent fix, but it seems like everyone's saying that it was done fairly quickly and in advance of whatever was scheduled. So kudos to everybody. Also, great news for holiday travelers. AAA predicts about 465,000 people from our region will be hitting the road. So a lot of folks will pass right through I-95.
That's right. All right.
There you go.
On to the next one.
Pro-Palestinian demonstrators at Drexel University, they cleared out their encampment today without incident or arrest. And Avi, let me tell you this. It came after Drexel police gave a warning around 5 o'clock this morning to clear out before the Philadelphia Police Department arrived to assist. And officials say the protesters just packed up their tents and they left. That simple. Nobody was arrested. No force was used. And these protesters had set up tents on the Corman Quad. It began Saturday after a march in Center City. It started with 12 tents, ended with around 35. And Drexel University President John Fry had called for that encampment to disband. He said many protesters on campus were not necessarily affiliated with the school. And so now, you know, they're gone. This is very different than what we've seen
very
on television
different.
At Columbia and different universities with battles and people being
UCLA
arrested.
Especially, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And literally thousands of students have been arrested across the country if you add everyone up. But here, they just said, we're going to go. And that was it.
Yeah, and I think they, the encampment organizers had framed this as something that they intended to do, like kind of a managed retreat. So I guess we'll see what that means, whether that means setting up an encampment somewhere else or some other sort of action. You know, the story's really never over with this, but like you said, the contrast between this and what we've seen around the country couldn't be starker.
Yeah.
Here's another stark thing, and it relates back to our first story because it has to do with highways. There's a billboard in our region. It's popped up in Philly. That was deemed one time too controversial for New York City itself, Gotham.
Wow.
So this is a billboard for a Cheltenham-based company called Swell. And it features cookbook author, famed cookbook author, Molly Boz. What I guess makes it controversial is that she is mostly topless, except she is covering a choice part of her top with two cookies. They're lactation cookies because this company called Swell, that they make lactation cookies to help with your lactation when you're breastfeeding. And apparently it was up in Times Square for a while. It was flagged for review, meaning a lot of people complained about the image. But the complaints then kind of triggered backlash because people were like, well, what's offensive about this? You have lingerie models up in Times Square all the time. Is it just because it's breastfeeding based and the model in this case is pregnant? And so that kind of created like a counter support for the campaign. And now it has come to our region. I think the billboard is at 5th and Callow Hill and then two spots along the PA Turnpike in Plymouth Meeting and Lower Southampton. So should I say any more about this? I think we got the gist.
Well, I think the backlash, after the backlash, the advertising that you're seeing in our area was provided for free.
For free? Oh,
for
wow.
For free because they wanted to support Swell, you know, and the backlash, you know, and the fact that her billboard had been taken down. And I love how people are standing up to try to normalize images of pregnant women and images of mothers who are breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. I mean, we need to move in that direction. And these ads will continue for another few weeks because the company, which is called Keystone, based in the area,
that's the billboard company.
Yeah, the billboard company. Yeah. They're going to allow the billboard to continue for a few weeks in wherever they have free space. So there you go.
I didn't even know that there was a Cheltenham-based company making lactation cookies.
Yeah.
So I learned that because of this whole thing.
Learn something new.
Check it out. So final story before we pivot to Newsmaker. This is one that's near and dear to you, I think.
Maybe.
Well, you were intrigued by it. I shouldn't say near and dear. Let me retract.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever heard of quiet vacationing? And I asked that question. It's where you take time off without telling your boss.
Can I just say something real quick? You are one of the hardest working people I know, constantly busy. So when I say near and dear, I meant just that you found it interesting.
I do find this interesting. I was shocked. This new Harris poll finds
that... She's the hardest working person in radio.
Well, a new Harris poll finds that Gen Z and millennials, they are less likely to take paid time off, but they are instead quiet vacationing. And their survey found that 78% of all employees don't take all of their vacation time, but Gen Z and millennial employees, they use this sort of sneaky method. And the reason is they don't want to seem like slackers.
Okay.
And they don't take their personal time off. But, you know, nearly half admitted that they take time off without asking their manager. How did they do that? Well, they move their mouse around to trick the productivity tracking software. They also will schedule emails to be sent out during times that they're supposed to be working, but they're not really working. And it raises all sorts of, you know, ethical questions, Avi. I mean, should we have more transparency at work?
No.
You know, and encourage people to take their paid time off?
No, if you're getting your work done, it doesn't bother me.
Is it wrong to sneak time off when you actually have the days and could take it off and let everybody know?
I am not an expert, but I did watch the show Mad Men, based in the 1960s. And those guys never worked, okay? They were doing 3 martini lunches every day, sitting on their couches in their office with the doors closed. So let's not put this on the Zoomers and the Millennials. Quiet vacationing has a long and cherished history in this country.
Facts.
This is just a technological update.
Look at you defending the generation. I love it.
Okay, we're already having fun.
Yes.
But before we dive into all the ways to have fun this weekend and this summer at the Jersey Shore, let's get a rundown of what the most popular towns are doing to keep beaches and visitors safe. Rowdy teens, going back to bashing the Zoomers here, rowdy teens and underage drinking have prompted Sea Isle, Ocean City, and so many more destinations to enact curfews and other restrictions for minors.
And leave those cabanas at home. They are banned from North Wildwood's eroded beaches, at least for now. So here to fill us in on the latest Jersey Shore rules is Henry Savage. He's a civics reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Henry, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me. And I've been listening to you guys for years, Radio Legends, so it's very cool to be here.
Whoa, thank you. Strong start by Henry. So this cabana thing, North Wildwood, what's going on? Why? What can't you do? And what is the explanation for why you can't do it?
Sure. And it's probably best to start with the explanation where North Wildwood has been a town where erosion, where, you know, waves are whipping and lashing against the beaches and it erodes that sand. Now, they haven't got a replenishment in 10 years since after Hurricane Sandy.
Wow.
Because of that, and there, you can look into it, there are lawsuits, there, you know, there was a state between the Department of Environmental Protection and North Wildwood. They've been going back and forth for years. Finally, they're getting their replenishment, but in the meantime, there's not a lot of beach, you know, space for these cabanas, canopies, larger tents. So in the interim, until this beach replenishment happens, they're just going to ban big tents, cabanas, and only allow you to have like a 8-foot-wide umbrella.
Umbrella, towel, and that's kind of it.
That's kind of it.
Yeah.
Now, the mayor did say once this replenishment is finished, which they expect 4th of July weekend. We don't know if that'll happen. That's what they expect. But he did say that they will reconsider that ban once that replenishment happens because they're hoping much more beach will be there for maybe some cabanas.
So for now, no cabanas. I want to move on to the curfews.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, because teenagers, a lot of people got kids. What are the rules? Where are the rules? And let's walk us through it.
Totally. And to kind of set the stage on this one, too, I think one of the big kind of facts or figures that stood out to me was specifically in Ocean City. In 2021, they had around 13,000 curbside warnings. They can be for pretty much anything. In the next year, they had up to like 44,000 curbside warnings. So it gives an idea of kids have always, teens have always partied at the beach, gone to beaches, maybe done things at night. However, post-COVID, these towns have just seen a large influx of kids, teens, where hundreds are gathering. There is some drinking. There's some vandalism. And so for a few years, they were really kind of struggling to kind of contain the issue. Mm. These curfews, backpack bans, earlier beach closures, they are in place to try to curb those things. So in the most strictest curfews is 10 p.m. So in some towns, 10 p.m. cutoff happens and most teens need to be, you know, back at home with their, you know, families or vacation homes.
Or what? They can be cited? Or what exactly happens if they break the curfew?
That's a really great point because for these laws, no one's going to get arrested. That's kind of what they're trying to say. Like if someone is breaking these rules, they're not going to arrest you or put criminal charges on you, but they are allowed to stop you, identify you, and then call your parents to come pick you up. And actually in the most you know, the most severe case of a parent not knowing where their kid was. There was one parent that had to drive from Connecticut down to Ocean City to pick up his kid.
And that's an angry drive.
I know, that's right. And the drive back, and gotta ask you about the backpacks. What is allowed and what isn't allowed?
Yeah, and the backpack ban, along with the beach closures, is kind of contentious because it's not just teens that those rules are for. They're for adults, too. So the backpack ban is basically 8-inch by 6-inch by 8-inch bag. If you have something bigger than that, they can stop you. They can fine you. So basically, there are some exceptions, medical devices. If you have a diaper bag, I'm sure they might give you some leniency. But for the most part, they're just kind of saying, don't bring bags. We think teens are hiding alcohol and other stuff in them.
So they think. Yeah. And that leads me to my next question, which is any of this working? Because some of this has been rolled out in past seasons. We've got some new rules this year. But is there actual proof, and are business owners or town officials saying this actually works to curb the behavior we're trying to curb?
So it's been, it's for the most part, it's been the affirmative that a lot of local police and officials have said it's worked. There has been less of these instances. In Ocean City in particular, we did some reporting where some of that activity actually spread to other parts of the town, whereas the beaches closed, boardwalks were getting a little bit more policed. Other parts of the town were starting to report more of these teens.
Hmm.
So in some cases, it has worked. In other cases, it's kind of just changed the makeup of how that works down there.
Any idea on whether this is going to impact people's decision to go to the shore with their teenagers?
You know what? I think it could. I think the biggest thing, though, is just New Jersey prices and vacation rentals. Yeah. We've done some reporting on that, too.
That's the real deterrent, yeah.
We just did one where it said, you know, sometimes there was one family that found it cheaper to fly to Florida, book a vacation there, than do a whole week in Wildwood.
Yeah.
So it could, but I think, to be honest with you, with all these rules, if you're just going for a family vacation, you're not really going to party, which Ocean City... Why are you partying in Ocean City? It's a dry town. But if you're just going for family vacation, most of these rules aren't going to affect you. They're not really going to be out here enforcing, like, and foot patrols, making sure this stuff happens. So it's mostly if you're a teen, you're going down thinking that the Jersey Shore is a party. That's not really when it's
party
be.
Might be over. And that drive back,
like,
I believe,
womp, womp.
The drive back is whoop whoop, right?
Yeah. Okay.
That's Henry Savage, civics reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks so much for the time, Henry.
Thank you for having me.
And we heard what not to do at the shore, but there's so much to definitely check off your bucket list this summer. Give us a call with your Jersey recommendations, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. Lots to come.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way, Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Oh, the Jersey Shore. Mm. Can't you just picture it? The boardwalks, the beach, those sweet summer nights. Oh, it's almost here, Cherry.
And don't forget about the taffy. Mm-mm-mm. From Wildwood to Cape May, from Ocean to Atlantic City, there's no place like the Jersey Shore. And with us today is Peter Genovese. He is the author of many, many, many books about the Garden State, the latest one being The Ultimate Guide to the Jersey Shore. Pete, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Before we kick off our conversation with Pete, I want to remind you.
Cherry, we're going to have to get you down to the shore.
I know.
That's my goal for this year, to get Cherry down to the shore.
It's going
to
happen, Pete. It's going to happen. Before we kick off our conversation with Pete, though, I want to remind you, our listener, that we want to hear from you. Are you going to the shore this weekend, this summer? What are you most excited about? What annoys you? Do you have a favorite secret spot that you're willing to share with us? What's gotten better? What's gotten worse? What's your SPF? Whatever you want to tell us, the number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
And so I wanted to start it with a note we got from Paulie on Instagram. Pete, he says, the best shore is Delaware. You probably heard earlier that I'm not a big Jersey Shore person, but I want to open this conversation by you telling us what you love so much about the Jersey Shore. Lay it out. Sell us.
Well, everything. Well, we have to forget a couple things. First of all, the traffic on the parkway.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Parkers, you know, just trying to go into any short town, it is an issue with parking. You have to drive around the block. You may have to go into the next town to park. Apart from that, the shore is, and I've said it before, I have an essay this weekend on NJ.com, why the shore matters. You know, I think it's in our DNA. To me, I lived almost half my life down the shore. I can't imagine living anywhere else. You know, I need to be near the water. I need to have like open sky. I need to have seagulls stop crabbing on my deck is what I need to have. That's part of what living, you know, there's, I'm not making the shore out to be like this sort of idyllic place, because like I said, there are a lot of headaches, especially in the summertime. But apart from all that, it's just, you know, there's so many places to explore, so many places where you can get away from the crowds. If you want crowds, you can go to Ocean City and Wildwood. If you want romantic, go to Cape May. There's, you know, each shore town, you know, from San Diego all the way down to Cape May has its own personality. So you can sort of tailor your Jersey Shore experience by picking a town. You know, Belmar is different from Spring Lake. Asbury Park is different from Ocean Grove, which is right next door. I mean, two towns cannot be more unlike each other. But this just so much, you know, it's like a question. I could go on, obviously, as you can tell, forever talking about why the shore.
I love your enthusiasm, matters Pete.
Matters
I love your
me.
Enthusiasm. Yes.
Like I said, you have to sort of ignore the traffic and, you know, in the summertime, you know, pretty much any restaurant that's any popular restaurant, you might have to either make reservations, or wait in a long line to get in or come back another night. You know, so that sort of goes with being a New Jerseyan at the Jersey Shore. You know, we could, but you know, if you're a Jersey and a real Jersey, and you can put up with pretty much anything. But like I said, at the shore, you sort of have to grin and bear it a lot of times. But again, there's so much. It's so, you know, my latest book, Ultimate Guide to New Jersey Shore, you know, where to eat, where to stay, what to do with the kids. It really covers the whole shore. You know, I can't imagine you know, picking up that book and not coming away with, you know,
something you like.
A little something for everybody.
Well, so let's get into it. Let's get into it here, Pete. So I want to start with a comment from Bonnie, who says, you have to mention Island Beach State Park. It is 8 miles of untouched shore, about an hour and a half from Philly. So you talked about getting away from the crowds. Where is a good spot on the Jersey Shore to do that? Perhaps it's Island Beach State Park.
Well, yes and no. Island Beach, it's enormously popular. And if you're going to go down there on a weekend, you need to get there by, say, 9 o'clock, because 11 or noon, they shut it down. Once they fill a certain amount of parking spaces, that's it. You can't get in unless, here's an inside tip, you have a bike. Not only you can just ride in on your bike, you don't have to pay the admission fee. I forget what it is now. It might be like $10. So bike, and then you could just sort of pull over anywhere. And there are long stretches of beach where you might not find anybody, where the crowds come in, or for like the first public parking area, which is a couple miles inside the entrance. But like I said, it's you know, it's a great beach, long. Beach itself is nice and sandy. But again, if you don't get there at a certain time on a weekend, you better get there before noon, because once they fill up those parking spaces, they shut it down. You can't get in unless you're on a bike.
Well, where would you go to get away from the crowds then, Pete?
Well, here's I mean, their beaches. Let's start with the free beaches, because, you know, nothing like free, especially since pretty much all beaches in Jersey are at the Jersey Shore are you have to have a beach tag. But there are 5 free beaches, and one of them might be my favorite to get away, and that's Strathmere, which is in Upper Township, you know, Cape May County. Parking, nice beach, no crowds, no boardwalk, no rides, no pretty much nothing except a beach, and it's free. Strathmere, Upper Township. The other free beaches are the three Wildwoods: Wildwood Crest, North Wildwood, and Atlantic City. A lot of people don't realize that Atlantic City is a free beach. So again, those are the only 5 free beaches in New Jersey. And I would recommend, like I said, Strathmere. Also right next door, Corson's Inlet State Park, which is not a great beach. But again, if you want to get away from the crowds, and Ocean City is just to the north, but, you know, Ocean City can get enormously crowded on the weekend. So Corson's Inlet, just south of there. And then just south of that is Strathmere.
Wonderful. I want to bring a caller. We have Levi from Summers Point on the line. Levi, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Oh, thank you so much. Peter, I don't know if you'll remember, but about 10 or 12 years ago, you took a tour of the James Candy Factory.
Yes.
And I was your tour guide.
Oh, that's great.
Wait, remember, what is the James Candy Factory? You. Fill us in, guys.
Are you still working there?
They did the tours for a couple of years, and they haven't been done since. They actually sold the building recently. It's going to become condominiums, I believe.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
So, well, let's fill in the – thanks for the call, Levi.
Thank you,
Pete,
Levi.
Can you fill in the gaps here? So, the James
– So, James and Frelinger, they're famous makers of saltwater taffy. Oh. That's what they do. Yeah, they make other candies, too, but saltwater taffy – you know, the shore has, for a long time, has gone Daffy over Taffy.
I love Taffy, too.
But the story, like, who buys this stuff? Do you actually buy it and take it home and eat it? I always wondered about that. I mean, they sell millions of pounds of it every year, but who actually... Okay, so I found one person who actually buys it and apparently eats it. That's Sherry, but
it's delicious.
I think it's pretty good. And so he said it was being turned into condominiums. I actually wanted to ask a question off of that. There's always consternation about sort of the older stuff on the Jersey Shore being knocked down, and big stuff, McMansions, condos, being put in its place. What are the trend lines you're seeing down the shore now? Has that leveled off, or is it still continuing apace?
There's still, you know, you go to three towns, especially Stone Harbor, Sea Isle, and I forget my other town, but those three towns, and Avalon they're all before you get to Cape May. I mean, the McMansion Central, you know, if there's an empty lot or a smaller home that's sold, they tear it down and they build. You know, it's pretty much all built up, all three towns, but there's still, you know, if you want to see serious McMansion activity, go to those three towns. I lived 7 years in Manasquan, you know, a little further north. It was my absolute, still part of, tender parts of my memory. But it lost its appeal for me. They had sort of a boardwalk, an astronaut boardwalk, a lot of these small sort of funky bungalows, shore, you know, people rented for the summer. And they started building these gigantic, ugly townhouses right on the boardwalk. Mm. I mean, and I moved out shortly after. I mean, like, don't do this to my town.
Yeah.
But that's the
trend.
That's the story up and down the coast. There's empty lots or somebody... You know, and some maybe can't blame the owner. You know, they have this whole house that they bought for $10,000 back in the 60s, and now someone's offering them $1 million. Yeah, I'd take it and move to Florida. Sure, why not? But so that's sort of inescapable. I'm not sure there's anything we can do to stop it. Hmm. But
so I want you to help me plan a day, Pete. I love boardwalks, clearly, because that's where I buy the taffy. So if you could just tell me what if I was looking for like a boardwalk day, maybe, and have like a couple hours where I wanted to be on the beach, where would I start? What town would you suggest? And give me some of the best boardwalks with slightly okay beaches, but they don't need to be the best.
Right. Well, my favorite boardwalk, the best boardwalk in New Jersey, which makes it the best boardwalk on earth, is Wildwood.
Okay.
I mean, so I have childhood memories. We, you know, I grew up in Trenton. We'd go down for a couple summers, stay in Sea Isle. And if we behaved ourselves, me and my brothers and sisters would get to spend the night on the Wildwood boardwalk, a little spending money. So it's still, but I think for boardwalk, it just has so much. There's just, you know, games and rides and places to eat, good places to eat. You know, Seaside is probably its closest. Seaside and Ocean City are its closest competitors. Seaside's more of a, I wouldn't call it rowdy, but it attracts a younger crowd. Ocean City, if you have family especially, if you want to take kids and you don't want to get pecked to death by seagulls, which is a problem you have down in Wildwood, Ocean City they've hired a falconer to keep the seagulls away from the people and their slices of pizza. They actually hire a falconer. Falcon.
Wow.
Yes, it costs amazing.
So the falcon flies around and picks off the seagulls?
It's a deterrent. You know,
oh, it's a deterrent. Okay.
He's like a security.
Falcon, like, let's go somewhere else. Let's go to Seaside.
Got it. It's sort of like having a cat to keep the mice out of your apartment.
Yeah. Interesting.
Exactly, yeah. And Wildwood, I think Wildwood may have hired one also. But like I said, Ocean City is... You know, it's they build themselves as America's greatest family resort. It's absolutely a dry town, as you mentioned before. It's absolutely, I think, if a piece of paper drops on the boardwalk, someone is there immediately to scoop it up. I mean, They are really, they really, that's the cleanest town, or the cleanest boardwalk anyway, in the Jersey Shore. But again, they're totally different experiences. Wildwood, Ocean City, Cape May, of course, if you want, like I said, most romantic town, all the Victorian B&Bs, a couple of really good restaurants, a nice beach, not a wide beach, but it's a really good beach. And I think we ranked it as the NJ.com. We had a couple of our reporters ranked every Jersey Shore beach, and they had Cape May ranked as number one.
Oh, just saw that, yeah.
Wow. Like I said, this is a small, you know, it's a more tranquil experience. Like I said, you know, more like romantic. You know, it's a great place to get away with your significant other, but it's not, you know, no rides. There's no amusements. You know, restaurants. It doesn't have anything of the pop that Wildwood or Ocean City has.
Let me read a comment here from Richard, who said, and this is a great story. Richard says, my mom and dad are in their 90s. And speaking of boardwalks, they met on the Atlantic City boardwalk. My mom was leaning against the railing in a brown dress, and my dad was immediately smitten with her. The end of June will be their 71st anniversary. They've been fighting the whole time and love each other very much. There's a Jersey story for you. I want to pivot now, before we run out of time, Pete, to places to eat. I really want an underrated place to eat, or places to eat, places that are not going to be mobbed, don't have to wait in a long line, but have good, solid Jersey Shore food. Give me some names.
I've done lists of best restaurants in Cape May, 11 best restaurants in Cape May, 11 best restaurants in Atlantic City. I'll give you one in Atlantic City. Setara, S-E-T-A-A-R-A. It's a really, from the outside, it looks like has these minarets. You know, it looks like this sort of mini castle. Hmm. And inside, it's just fat. You should look it up. Look up at the interior. It's just this, it's like you're in a courtyard in Casablanca or something.
Wow.
But it's the city's only French restaurant. Believe it or not, it's the only French restaurant in Atlantic City. And it's also the only Afghan restaurant. So they sort of combine the two.
Wow.
Just a strike. Not easy to get into. You have to make a reservation. You know, it's not a big place, but Setara, it's totally, you know, and I've said this in my ranking of Atlantic City restaurants. I say you don't have to go to a casino to have a really good meal in Atlantic City. And Setara is an example of that. Cape May, Sapori Italiano, for Italian food. It's in West Cape May. And also in West Cape May, if you want to, the shore's most, the shore's most outlandish dish can be found at Exit Zero's filling station, West Cape May. It's called the Kraken. It's this like inky black ink curry with pot peppers. It looks like something you'd repair potholes with.
Really,
you're not really selling it with that, but I like the food description, if not the aesthetic description.
Kraken at Exit Zero filling station. It's a neat place. You can sit inside or outside. And they actually have an Airstream trailer. You can actually eat in there also, in the trailer, and benches outside. But it's a really cool place. So both those places in West Cape May, Sapori Italiano and Exit Zero filling station.
We have a comment from Meg who said, my parents go to Chef Bola's every year in AC. Reservations needed like 2 months in advance unless you know someone, and they've been name dropping for a decade. So there you go, Meg.
You got to know someone. You got to know someone.
Yeah, and if you're trying to... Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, go ahead. It may be exaggerating a little bit. I think it's a little easier, you know, 2 months. Yeah, maybe it's just a month. But you can't make reservations online. You have to call them up, leave your name, and they'll get back to you, which is really, you know, they don't believe in the internet, basically.
Old school.
Wow.
But there's two, but I think there's a better Italian restaurant in Atlantic City, Cafe 2825. We did this big statewide Italian restaurant showdown about 5 years ago, and I picked them as the best over Chef Bolo's, over a bunch of other really great Italian restaurants. Reservations a little hard to get into at Cafe 2825, but I think they're better than Chef Bolo's. It's right by the Tropicana on one of the main drags, not in the casino, but right, just a block or two from the Trop. So Cafe 2825. And Chef Ol is, I mean, it's an experience. No credit cards, bring plenty of cash. The veal chops are legendary. But like I said, if I have to pick one of the two, Cafe 2825.
Love it. And we only have about a minute and a half left in the segment, but I gotta ask you, if you're thinking about spending a week in the Jersey Shore, along the Jersey Shore, your advice on how to stay within a certain budget, because it's getting super expensive these days. Any budget advice?
Well, their budget, you know, obviously if you're going to stay along the ocean or anywhere, you know, block from the ocean, you're going to pay premium prices. So I would say if you can get a nice hotel, you know, a mile or two away. I mean, I walked Long Beach Island from top to bottom last summer for a story on Long Beach Island. And I was making I needed a hotel for like two nights. And all the hotels and motels, like during the week, were like $400 and up. $400 during the week.
Wow.
That's how, but the LBI is sort of like a world of its own. Cay May, you know, I stayed there a couple of years ago. The B&Bs, you know, if you sort of scout around, you can find decent deals. They're not going to charge you $400 a night. And there are plenty of B&Bs in Cay May. So I, like I said, shop around. Check for special deals and packages, and you know that if I had to spend a weekend somewhere at a reasonable price, I would say Cape May.
It's romantic, mm-hmm. and you can spend a weekend for a reasonable price. I'm getting kind of sold.
I know.
On Cape May.
I feel like Cape May has
that might be the
asterisk.
One for me.
Yeah,
and you can go to Wildwood at night. You know, Cape May.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no nightlife in Cape May.
Cape May during the day,
Wildwood at night for the boardwalk and the taffy.
And the taffy.
One thing you must do, I know you're tight on time. One thing you must do at Wildwood, the Ferris wheel. Take it at night above, and you know, you go high above Wildwood's neon lit magnificence. It's just, it might be the coolest thing you do at the Jersey Shore all summer.
I feel like I'm there already. That's Peter Genovese, culture and culinary reporter for NJ.com and author of The Ultimate Guide to the Jersey Shore. Peter, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I think I have a full weekend planned thanks to Peter. So
I think we're ready to go. We're also ready to go to segment three after this, a Memorial Day story for you just on the other side of this break. This is Studio 2.
But of all the places I can't think of,
supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way, Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. What happens after an American soldier is killed overseas? These days, the policy is to bring those soldiers back home. But that wasn't always the case. And in fact, there are an estimated 130,000 Americans buried at 26 sites around the world.
One of those people buried on foreign soil is a Philadelphian named Earl Wolf Sr. Earl's body is at the Netherlands American Cemetery, located in a town called Margraten. And this cemetery is unusual. Each of the graves, just over 8,000 of them, have been adopted by a local Dutch family.
For most of his life, Earl's son, Earl Wolf Jr., didn't know about this adoption program. In fact, he didn't know much about his father at all. But eventually, the cemetery and its unique connection to the Dutch people set him on a quest to fill in those blanks. Avi brings us this Memorial Day story.
In the spring of 1945, the news from Europe was triumphant. Allied armies were smashing through Western Germany.
The storm breaks in full final fury on the German Rhine.
Somewhere amid the bombs and the bullets and the chaos was a 29-year-old native of West Philadelphia, Earl Wolf Sr. His son, Earl Jr., was back in Philly, then just 2 years old. Today, he's 81.
I always had this in the back of my head. What was going on when my father was killed on April 7th, 1945?
For years, Earl Jr. knew almost nothing. His father had died somewhere in Germany. That was it. Almost exactly a month later, on May 8th, the war in Europe came to its merciful end.
The great moment arrives as the surrender papers are prepared.
Earl Sr.'s body was laid to rest under a simple cross at the Netherlands American Cemetery in Margraten. Nestled in a quilt of neatly planted fields, Margraten was only a temporary home for some soldiers. Upon request, many of the bodies were repatriated. but not Earl Sr.'s. He was among the roughly 8,000 who would spend eternity in this little strip of land squeezed between Belgium and Germany. As for why, all Earl Jr. knows is what his mother told him.
When my father left, they had a heart-to-heart talk, and he said that if I can't come back as a whole person the way I'm leaving, then you leave me with the rest of my buddies, wherever that may be.
And you don't really know why he said that.
I don't know. It was something between the two of them.
And for much of Earl's life, that's where the conversation stopped. He grew up, he went to Overbrook High School, his father's alma mater, and he carried on with his life.
My mom, I think for a period of her life, she was in denial. But she never had a passport. She never went out of the country. Obviously, she never went to visit there.
And that might have been Earl Jr.'s story, too, except that in 1983, his soon-to-be wife, Jackie, issued an ultimatum.
She says to me, if we're going to have a life going forward, you need to go, because I had never gone to the cemetery. I'd never been there.
She wanted you to go.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because she said that you just need to have some closure.
And so they went. The summer of 1983, a trip for closure. And it ended up doing the opposite.
As I look back on it, it was the beginning of me saying, I got to find out the rest of the story.
As the physical distance between Earl and his father's grave finally gave way, so did the emotional distance. At 41 years old, he finally wanted to know, where did my father die? Why? For what? And just as the cemetery prompted those questions, in a way, it also provided the answers. So, Jonathan, tell me where you live.
Oh, yes, I will. But can I first say hi to Earl?
Of course. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey. Hi, Earl.
That is the voice of Jonathan Wonders, a Dutch artist from the southeastern corner of the Netherlands. He's 42 now, about the same age Earl was when he began his quest for answers. But Jonathan was a much younger man when he decided to become the official Dutch caretaker of Earl Sr.'s grave.
I adopted the grave around 2005.
The villagers of Margraten have been part of the cemetery's story from the moment it was established, 80 years ago, in 1944. Some villagers contributed labor digging the actual graves, and since 1945, many more have participated in its grave adoption program, a sign of appreciation from the Dutch people to their allied liberators. Jonathan says adopting a grave doesn't come with any specific obligations.
But I think most of the people who adopt a grave, they feel a responsibility. It's just something you do. It's up to you how you fill it in.
Many of the adopters bring flowers to the graves on major holidays, but informally, they also serve as emotional and informational conduits, a bridge for Americans seeking a sense of closeness to relatives buried many thousands of miles away.
But it's like an extended family that it's not just a gravesite in a faraway place. It's somebody cares.
Earl and Jonathan have been sending notes back and forth for years, and in 2014, they met in person for the first time. Shortly after that, Jonathan was contacted by a woman in Arizona who was looking for Earl.
She did some research and contacted the adoption program because she found out, well, it's very easy to find that out, where he was buried in Margraten.
And all of this ultimately led to the woman emailing Earl directly.
She was going through her father-in-law's attic because he had recently passed away. And she opens up a box, and what does she find? She finds all this stuff that he had from the World War II.
This woman's father-in-law had been in the same company and division as Earl Wolfe Sr.
But here's the interesting piece. He was a writer, and he kept his own personal daily diary of everything that was going on,
including an entry for April 7th, 1945.
And she sent me a copy of the entire diary, which talked about exactly what they were doing and how they were approaching this bridge and taking control.
This bridge turned out to be the bridge where Earl Sr. died. It's a little span over the Sieg River, which eventually empties into the Rhine. After decades, Earl Jr. had his where, his what, his why. Along a small, bucolic river northeast of Bonn, the Allies had taken a bridge from the desperate Germans, and in that mission, Earl Sr. gave his life. Earlier this year, Earl Jr. made his third visit to Margraten, but this time, he added a little side trip to the banks of the Sieg River, with Jonathan behind the wheel.
We found the bridge, and we actually walked across this bridge.
This was, as you might imagine, overwhelming.
79 years ago, somewhere around here, my father was here. Yeah. And as the day went on and we walked around the area and so on, it became almost like the final piece.
At this point, Earl doesn't know if he'll ever make it back to Margraten again. But finally, he feels okay with that.
Not to sound corny, but I am at peace with all of this at this point.
That must feel good. Maybe it feels bittersweet. I don't know.
No, it feels good.
Yeah.
It feels good. Yeah, it feels good.
That Jonathan was there in this moment of closure and clarity is fitting. Yes, because he helped make it happen, but also because his relationship with Earl exemplifies the very best of Margraten.
The cemetery is also kind of place that it inspires people to care for each other, even if you don't know each other.
In the years since Jonathan and Earl met, Jonathan had a son, and that son is now about to turn 5. Someday, he'll adopt a grave of his own. And maybe, someday, a relative of that soldier will reach out, and the cycle of connection and discovery will begin again.
For me, the place is kind of a promise that for the next generations that we should care for each other.
With all the problems we have, there is still people that care. So before you go, Jonathan, give David a big hug for us.
I will. Thank you, Earl. And greetings to Jack.
And one postscript that I wanted to add from Earl. He actually did some research and discovered that more than 1,000 of the roughly 8,000 soldiers buried in the Netherlands American Cemetery are from Pennsylvania. Another 350 are from New Jersey. So an unusually high percentage are from our region. And Earl told me that he hopes someone will hear this story and maybe go on the journey that he went on.
What a lovely story, Avi. And I just love the idea of, you know, making a promise to the next generation and caring for each other and passing it down. That was beautiful. Just in time for Memorial Day.
Just in time for Memorial Day. I guess on a less poignant
note,
we did get some more emails about the Jersey Shore. And well, this is kind of poignant. Judy from Margate told us that she was really kind of feeling it when we're talking about how they're tearing down those little cottages mm-hmm. and replacing them with larger buildings. And that's happened where she lives. And then Ellen said, it's cheaper to fly and stay in Portugal than it is to go to New
Ellen,
Jersey.
Ellen, look, I didn't even know what to say when I saw Ellen's email. But, you know, to everybody, I hope you have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. Are you doing anything?
I'll be here on Monday.
Monday.
Holding it down.
Yeah. I actually took Monday off.
Good for you.
You know, and I'm looking forward to just hanging out. So
those are holidays.
Yeah,
you're entitled to them.
That
no
is
true. No quiet vacationing.
No quiet vacationing needed. And so with that, I want to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes, Diana Martinez, engineered today's show. WHYY's audio general manager is Joan Isabella. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Safe travels to those headed out for the long weekend. We wish you a meaningful Memorial Day, and we'll be back next week.